The man accused of kidnapping and murdering U of I's Yingying Zhang 2 years ago could face the death penalty. We'll bring you the latest with his trial now underway in Peoria. Plus, agriculture is the leading cause of methane emissions in the U.S. We'll speak with one central Illinois farmer who's changed the way he farms, in part so he could reduce his emissions. And we've been talking about podcasts we're listening to this summer, Later Nerdette and Good Christian Fun.
The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WNIJ in DeKalb, and WCBU in Peoria.
That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Coming up later this hour, we speak with one Illinois farmer about why he's moving away from growing just one crop and what that has to do with climate change. We'll also end today's show with some more podcast recommendations for you to listen to this summer. But first, it's the sixth day of trial for 29-year-old Brent Christensen at the federal courthouse in Peoria. He's accused of the kidnapping and murder of Yingying Zhang, a Chinese visiting scholar at the University of Illinois. This happened 2 years ago on the Urbana campus, and now federal prosecutors could be seeking the death penalty. There are many horrific and gruesome details of this crime that have come out in the trial, but we thought today we would focus on the legal proceedings. Tanya Kuntz has been covering the trial for WILL. She's in court now, but I spoke with her yesterday afternoon after court had recessed for the day. Tanya, welcome to the 21st.
Hi, Nyla. Thank you for having me.
So Brent Christensen's defense lawyer said, actually, just even at the beginning of the trial, that his client was, their client was in fact responsible and did kill Yingying Zhang. Was that a surprise to people?
Oh, I think it was a big surprise. It was certainly a surprise to those sitting in the reporter row when his defense attorney said it does not serve justice, the interest of justice, to deny what happened or to deny that he killed her. They do take issue, however, with the way the prosecution contends the whole thing happened. Now, keep in mind that Christensen has pled not guilty, which means at this trial, it is still the government's burden of proof to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that Brent Christensen did this. And that's the tricky part. I think that's the part that is kind of confusing for all of us. Maybe sometimes up to and including the judge in some moments, because Christensen, of course, has pled not guilty. The government says for sure they think he did it, and here's their case. And yet it is still up to the jury to take in all the facts that they've been given and make a ruling on it.
Tanya, members of Yingying Zhang's family, including her parents and her brother, have also traveled from China to Peoria for the trial. In fact, her boyfriend or her fiancé, Xiaolin Ho, has also been there. Have any of them testified?
Xiaolin Ho took the stand, her boyfriend, whom in this country we may have even considered him her fiancé. They were planning to marry in October of the same year that she went missing. She went missing in June, of course, and they were planning to marry, he says, in October. So he took the stand early on to talk about who she was and to lay out that case of sort of her daily practice. They talked daily despite the 13-hour time difference between China and the U.S. That testimony, I think, probably gripped a lot of people because without a shadow of a doubt, that young woman had such incredible promise, right? The two of them had met in undergraduate school. They went through undergraduate school together. They had both earned a degree, 1 and 2 in their class, mind you, 1 and 2 in their class in environmental engineering. They both went on to do master's work. She concluded her master's work at Peking University and then was invited here to study photosynthesis of soybeans and corn. And that's what she was doing at the U of I when she went missing.
Tanya, so I wonder what happens next year. What do we know when the trial will end? How long this will take for the government to present its case?
Judge is planning on talking with the jury more about the direction they're going to go at the end of trial today. He concluded trial on Tuesday saying he thought that they were going to get very close to opening statements by Friday, but he really wants to be able to, if they're going to do that, start opening closing statements early Friday in early in the day, maybe conclude the day and allow the jury to have a weekend before they begin deliberation. But they're kind of at that cutoff point, he thinks. He thinks that it may be better served to start jury instruction or start closing statements on Monday, maybe, depending on where they get with wrapping up all witness testimony, you know, depending on how that ends.
And again, he can receive the death penalty because this is the federal government pursuing the case. That's why he's facing the death penalty?
So it's been a long time since the state of Illinois has put anybody to death. Illinois is one of 20 states that no longer or doesn't have the death penalty. And it has been an effort among this particular presidential administration to, in states that don't have the death penalty, to make use of federal proceedings, taking things to the federal level, if possible, where the death penalty is possible. Therein lies the difference. Because there was interstate commerce identified with the use of a cell phone, I believe, in this case, I believe that's what it was that kicked it up to they could charge it in federal court, and the FBI became involved very early on. Because it is a federal case, it can be a capital case, because in extremely heinous crimes, the death penalty still is viable at the federal level.
That's Tanya Kuntz, who's been covering this trial for WILL from Peoria. Tanya, thank you for being with me. I appreciate it.
Nyla, thank you for having me.
The trial resumes this afternoon. Please stay tuned to this NPR station for the latest updates on that as Tanya continues to cover it. As she said, lots of questions about this whole process. Jeff Erdankin is the director of the Center for Criminal Defense at Northwestern University's Pritzker School of Law. He joins us now from Chicago. Hi, Jeff. Good morning.
Hello. How are you?
Jeff, I wonder if you can remind us first. A lot of people would be confused by this. I was confused about this, how it's possible to plead not guilty even after Christensen's lawyer has admitted that his client was responsible for Yingying Zhang's death.
Virtually every defendant, state and federal court at the arraignment, that is the first proceeding after you're charged, enters a plea of not guilty. It's a formality.
And so it's a formality, but I think for people who are outside of legal circles, they might be confused. Why wouldn't you change it to guilty?
Somebody who's charged with an indictment that carries the death penalty is not going to be inclined at the time of arraignment to plead guilty. It's inconceivable and unheard of.
And so I think that as we're thinking about the way prosecutors are building this case, Jeff, I wonder if you can tell us a little bit about someone who I know you've been involved on the other side defending this, kind of a little bit of the thinking that goes into how you build a defense for this case when the prosecution is very clearly laying out lots of details about what happened here in this crime.
In almost every capital case, especially in federal court, the goal of the defense attorney is to avoid the death penalty for his or her client. So it's most of the energy and resources in these trials goes into anticipating what's called the penalty phase or the sentencing phase of the capital trial, where you're wanting to persuade the jury that your client does not deserve to be put to death, but instead should be given a life sentence.
And so, Jeff, two phases, right, of this trial, but is it the same jury?
Yes, it's the guilt phase where most people are familiar with how trials are conducted, where the question is the defendant on trial been proven guilty beyond a reasonable doubt by the prosecution? And in a capital case, if in this case he is convicted, which the evidence seems to suggest that he likely will be, then it will proceed to the penalty phase where the jury is going to hear what's called aggravation evidence and mitigation evidence. Aggravation evidence presented by the prosecution, mitigation presented by the defense, and then the jury is going to have to follow the judge's instructions at the end of that proceeding and determine whether or not the aggravating factors outweigh the mitigating factors, in which case they will vote to recommend a death sentence.
And in this case, we haven't heard, I think a lot of people in layman's parlance, we hear not guilty by reason of insanity. That's not happening here. But certainly defense attorneys have been talking about Christensen's mental health. This has been raised a lot. For example, he visited the U of I counseling center looking for help with suicidal and homicidal thoughts. I wonder what this distinction is between that plea of insanity versus bringing up examples of mental health.
You're right. This is not an insanity defense. That's a specific type of defense where it's alleged, it's asserted that because the defendant, for a variety of reasons, was incapable of understanding or didn't have the capacity to understand his actions, he would therefore be held not responsible, therefore not guilty. That's not what's happening here. What's the reason that the mental health evidence is being presented is to lay the groundwork for the penalty phase when the defense is going to argue that he should be held less culpable for the crime that he committed, in part because he is disturbed or has a diagnosable mental disorder.
And Jeff, is it up to the jury to decide? This is really the jury who has to make a decision about his mental health state and whether or not that he deserves the death penalty?
The jury's going to decide whether or not he deserves a death penalty, and they're going to report that to the judge with their verdict. His mental health and mental condition or whatever it might be, the evidence that comes in and presented in the defense part of this penalty phase is going to be one factor, but certainly not the only factor that the defense will argue as a reason that he shouldn't be sentenced to death.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking with Jeff Erdangen. He's a professor of law at Northwestern's University's Pritzker School of Law. He's also a director for the Center of Criminal Defense. And Jeff, you have personal experience with capital cases in several states, and I wonder how hard this is to sit through if you're, I mentioned this at the beginning, Yingying Zhang's family, many of her family have come from China. In some cases, her fiance testified for the trial. How difficult is that? I can't imagine what that must be like to sit through as a family member.
I can't imagine it either. I'm not an expert on how victims relate and react to these types of proceedings. But like you and any other person, I would find it to be beyond comprehension.
Mm-hmm. And I wonder for you what you think has stood out most to you about this case as you've been following it?
It's unusual for the government to seek the death penalty in the United States. It happens. Congress authorized federal capital cases to be brought in the late 80s. There haven't been all that many. And so it's unusual to see something like this. It's understanding the facts as I do of this case, at least as they're spelled out in the indictment and in the evidence that I've read about thus far, it strikes me that this is probably a case where the government was, in their eyes, justified in seeking the death penalty based on the nature of the case and the particularly heinous nature of the allegations.
And Jeff, is it particularly difficult in a state like Illinois where we've abolished the death penalty to then have that conviction? Does that make it more complicated?
I don't know that it does. It all depends on the facts of the case, the makeup of the jury, and honestly, the skill of the lawyers on both sides. So the fact that Illinois no longer has the death penalty doesn't seem to me to be a significant factor in determining the likelihood of a jury imposing the death penalty at the end of the case.
That's Jeff Erdangen, a clinical professor of law at Northwestern University's Pritzker School of Law. He's also director of the Center for Criminal Defense. Jeff, thank you for taking the time to speak with us about this, provide a little bit more analysis. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Earlier this week, we talked about how vehicles are now the biggest source of carbon emissions in Illinois. Cars, trucks, and other autos emit carbon dioxide. But when we think about other greenhouse gas emissions, there's also methane. And according to the EPA, agriculture is a leading producer of methane emissions in the U.S. And one big reason for that is cows. That's because the digestion process for that cows produce almost as much methane emissions as oil and gas. Madeline Beck from Harvest Public Media has been reporting on this, talking to some farmers who are trying to do things differently. After the break, we're going to have one of those farmers join us. Madeline's with us now. Hi, Madeline. Thanks for being with us.
Good to be here.
So, Madeline, I just want to start by just asking you, this is a question a lot of people have. Should I eat beef or not? Are farmers are thinking about this as well?
Oh, of course. And I mean, there's been a growing trend in the United States in general to move towards a vegetarian diet. There's pretty much in most big chains have vegetarian options now, which wasn't true maybe, 20, 30 years ago. And so I think that's definitely on farmers' minds. But as farmers are also trying to cater to an audience's want for more sustainability, what you might hear from that farmer coming up is it needs to be a mixture. They often have to have beef as part of that bigger picture operation of sustainability.
That's Madeline Beck with Harvest Public Media on the line with us from Galesburg, Illinois. After the break, we're going to be joined by a farmer in Atlanta, Illinois, the owner of Prairie Earth Farm, talking about his new practices of regenerative agriculture. Madeline's the one who brought Dave to us, so we will tweet out Madeline's stories if you want to read some of that. Follow 21ST Show. Just after the short break, we'll pick up this conversation with Madeline and Dave. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Right now, we're talking about greenhouse gases. We've been talking about that a little bit on The 21st this week. On Monday, we talked about vehicles being the biggest source of carbon emissions in Illinois. That's a new designation that's just happened. You can check out 21stshow.org for more information on that conversation. But right now, we're talking about agriculture and its role in greenhouse gas emissions. That's because cows are a big producer of methane gas within their digestion process. Well, some people are saying, as we've just been talking with Madeline Beck for Harvest Public Media about, the idea is to cut down or cut out beef consumption. Other farmers are saying that regenerative agriculture is a solution. Dave Bishop is the owner of Prairie Farm near Atlanta, Illinois, in the central part of the state, and he's on the line from there now. Hi, Dave. Welcome to the 21st.
Well, thank you for having me.
Dave, I wonder if you can tell us what you grow and raise at Prairie Earth Farm.
Well, we're a 480-acre farm in the middle of Illinois, and we focus on maintaining a diverse mix of plants and animals here. We grow corn and soybeans, small grains like wheat or oats, vegetable crops, and, of course, livestock, primarily cattle and hogs.
And how long have you been doing this, Dave?
Since 1979.
And before, were you always doing, I'm curious what led you to creating sort of this biodiversity, because I think oftentimes when we talk to farmers these days, they're either focused on mostly growing corn or mostly growing soy or livestock.
Well, we started out pretty much that way. And during the 1980s, especially specifically 1988, we had a very severe drought here. And when things come under stress, their weaknesses become easily apparent. And we realized that time that we were going to have to do something different. Fall harvested crops like corn and soybeans did very poor, but crops that were harvested in midsummer like wheat did better. We realized that if we had had cattle that year, that the corn, which produced no ear, could have been used as a forage crop instead of just becoming a lost crop. So we realized that more diversity was needed to make the system work better all around.
And Dave, when you were thinking about that, this was in the 80s, how common was this in agriculture? Were there many other folks thinking the way that you were?
Well, there was some. Organic agriculture was a thing at that time, not very well developed, but there were people working on the system, yes.
That's Dave Bishop, who owns Prairie Earth Farm, just southwest of Bloomington near Atlanta, Illinois. Madeline Beck is also with us. And Madeline, you know, we're listening to Dave. I wonder when we think about the economic history of this, when we saw farmers start to shift towards growing one or two crops instead of a variety.
So you really like that. It's been a very long haul, but you started seeing it really ramp up with cropland consolidation in the 50s, 60s and 70s. And a lot of people thought back then that it was largely driven by crop specialization. So if you produce a little of everything, you can set a certain price. But if you produce a lot of one thing through economies of scale, farmers found they could bring down that price. And it became harder for those diverse farms to compete with the big farms growing one thing. So yeah, so in the 50s, 60s, 70s is when you really saw cropland consolidation and crop specialization.
And now,
really take off.
Right. And we think about it now, Madeline, as you and I have had so many conversations on this program about, for example, the trade war, crop prices. When someone is doing something like what Dave is doing, that does provide a little bit more insulation economically when things are tough.
Yeah, no, absolutely. A lot of things, farmers who do have just the one or two crops, say they do a rotation of corn and soy, they will do different varieties of corn and soy. Some of them will have a little bit more hardier corn on half. So if they go through a drought, it won't be a complete loss. But that doesn't really help if you have a couple varieties of soy, if you don't have a single buyer for any of your soy and that sort of thing, especially if your buyer is China right now. It's a risky business to be in.
So Dave Bishop, as you're saying, you produce lots of different things, as you were talking about the diversity that's a part of Prairie Earth Farm. We started this conversation by talking about how cows are a major contributor to methane emissions. I wonder if you could just kind of explain that process for us. I think people think they're familiar with this, but they probably aren't in terms of how cows are actually emitting methane.
Well, of course, cows are ruminants. Naturally pass gas, if you will, during their digestive process. But when you're raising cattle on the land, when they're on the land grazing, as they would be in nature, the greenhouse gas emissions they produce are offset by the amount of carbon that they're contributing to the soil. So actually, they're a net carbon sink. And I'm looking here at a recent study done by Michigan State University that looks at the impact of soil carbon sequestration on life cycle greenhouse gas emissions.
And Dave, though, that has to do with the way that you are farming, though, that you're allowing the cattle, I imagine, to graze naturally. That's an important part of this process, right?
Right. And some people would say it's not the cow, it's the how. Yes.
So can you tell us a little bit more about the how?
Well, the how has to do with how the animals are fed and taken care of. For us, they're an important contributor to the land and to the farm's economy and to the ecological and agronomic benefit of the farm. If you're simply going to sequester cows in feedlots or raise them as monocultures and raise corn and soybean as monocultures, you're going to have problems with that. So by going to a system that creates more diversity and uses both plants and animals on the land together, these issues are much different than they appear.
And so I think maybe you could help us understand a little bit more about this, because I think some people think about the other and sort of maybe common or mass production methods of beef and cattle and think about the fact that that's why a lot of people have, as Madeline was talking about before the break, they've stopped eating beef because they think it's bad for the environment. I wonder if you could explain just how your method actually helps the environment, what the cattle are actually doing, and what the relationship is between cows and their grazing and the soil and carbon.
Well, first of all, I don't tell people what they should eat. I think you should eat whatever it is that you believe is right for you. But as a producer, if I want to grow food that is not dependent upon consumption of non-replaceable natural resources, if I want to avoid toxins and synthetic inputs, then I need this diverse mix of plants and animals on the land together to provide the ecosystem services, like fertility, for example, that I need to grow food. Somehow, and of course, if I'm doing that, both of these things have to contribute to the farm's economy. So I have to make them pay.
That's Dave Bishop, who's the owner of Prairie Earth Farms. As he's been talking about, he farms about 400 or so acres just southwest of Bloomington in Atlanta, Illinois. We've also been talking to Madeline Beck. And Madeline, I know for your reporting, you spoke with different researchers talking about this whole issue of beef consumption or not. And I wonder what researchers say about this issue.
Well, generally, if you talk to a lot of them, the overarching theme that they'll give you is reducing beef intake is the best thing you can do for reducing greenhouse gas emissions with your diet. That's your biggest role you can play. Of course, they're oftentimes they're seeing the bigger issues that Dave said, those other types of farms, these more larger operations that work in a little bit of a different way. But with the researchers, they don't kind of break it down to specific types of farm. For mm-hmm. them, it's overall. If you eat less beef, then you're going to contribute less emissions to the environment. But the same researchers, if you ask them to take it out of that closed system of like reducing emissions in this way, and ask them what is the most sustainable most sustainable method of farming to reduce greenhouse gases overall, they do mention farms like Dave's. So you have a diverse crop rotation and there are animals on there, including cows. But they do give the overall prescription of, yeah, if you want to reduce methane emissions, which, you know, methane's about 30 times more potent than carbon dioxide as a greenhouse gas, they suggest cutting out beef.
Dave, is this something that can happen on a small scale? Well, we're talking about the size of your, I mean, you're certainly not, I mean, you're in the hundreds of acres. That's not that small.
Well, it's small relative to many of the farms, of course, and there's not a lot of us yet. But I think as we look forward into the future, that agriculture is going to have to change the way it operates. We cannot continue to consume non-replaceable natural resources forever. And so at some point we have to move toward regenerative farming systems. And those farming systems are ultimately going to require us to have animals present on the land.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Madeline, as you know, it's not just cows, obviously, that have an impact on the environment. And I wonder what other parts of agriculture you've been looking at that emit greenhouse gases?
Oh, I mean, there's the three main greenhouse gases from agriculture, methane being one, carbon emissions being one, and another really big, nasty one being nitrous oxide emissions. Now, nitrous oxide is about 300 times more potent than carbon emissions in the atmosphere. And that comes from heavy applications of nitrogen fertilizer. So that ends up in the atmosphere. It doesn't last as long as carbon. It comes down a lot quicker, but it's also cutting that down, you would also see a lot quicker effects on mitigating climate change if you were to reduce that amount of fertilizer. And if you have more of a crop rotation, you have more plants putting different things into the ground, that's been shown to reduce the need for fertilizer, as well as spot fertilizer applications. But yeah, I mean, in general, as you've talked about on this show and other times, nitrogen fertilizer runoff has its own problem. With that extra fertilizer on the ground, you end up having a dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico and
right,
all sorts
and
of
and
other
our
problems.
Water supply and those sorts of things. Dave,
right.
When as you've with your biodiversity, I wonder how much or how little you need things like fertilizer and how much of that is natural.
Well, with a functional regenerative system, you would have no need for imported nitrogen fertilizer. We use cover crops and livestock together to provide that kind of fertility. So it really should not be necessary to use any synthetic crop inputs in order to feed the country.
And we know it shouldn't be necessary, but it is happening. And so, Dave, I just wanted to end by asking what you would say to other farmers who might be hesitant about moving away from what they have been doing, maybe growing just one or two crops and moving towards, as you've called this regenerative agriculture, this way, as you say, farming should be?
Well, you know, we've always had to adapt and change. Nobody is farming like Grandpa did, and we're always going to have to adapt and change. And so today you've got organic as one option that appeals to younger people especially. We've got industrial hemp production that we could replace one-third of our corn soybean acres and reduce our need for synthetic inputs. That would appeal to some farmers. So there are options, and we're just going to have to figure out the way forward.
This is Dave Bishop. Dave, thanks for sharing your way of doing farming with us. He's the owner of Prairie Earth Farm near Atlanta, Illinois. I want to thank Madeline Beck for bringing Dave to us. As we said, Madeline's been reporting on this for Harvest Public Media, and we'll have our stories up at 21stShow.org. Dave, Madeline, thank you for being with me. I appreciate it.
Good to be here.
Scroll through Podify or Apple Podcasts, and the sheer number of choices can be overwhelming. So what's the right episode to keep you laughing on that summer road trip, or one that will teach you something new on the way to work? There's a podcast out there for everyone. And to prove that, we're continuing our week-long focus on podcasts we love for you to hear. And one of them is called Good Christian Fun. Every week, Kevin T. Porter and his co-host Caroline Ely tackle different items of Christian pop culture with the podcast called Good Christian Fun.
So we're not going to make you go to church. We're not even going to try to. We're just here. We're kind of double agents. We've both grown up in this world.
Yes.
And now we're here to introduce you to it, to talk about it.
And now we're cool. We're outside of the world.
Now we can, you know.
We put our leather jackets on and our shades.
It's like we're by faith Yule. You know what I mean? Is that a thing? It's not.
What's our other faith then?
I don't know. The world?
Scientology.
Sure. In Scientology.
That's what I am.
L. Ron Hubbard, we love you. Come on the show. Please. So this is not a Christian show for Christians. That'd be boring.
That's a good Christian fun podcast. Kevin's actually with us now. Hey, Kevin. Welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here.
Hi, thank you so much for having me. Great to be here.
So, Kevin, I love the idea of this. Good Christian Fun could be, I feel like, the title of my younger years of life, of high school and probably college. And so with this podcast, I feel like you're looking at Christian pop culture and you're not making fun of it. You're asking, I love this description you have of not just, you're not saying like, what the hell, but you're saying what the heaven, as you put it.
Yes, that's our way of co-opting the classic phrase, what the hell, and making it Christian, as so much of Christian pop culture has done with regular culture and made it their own. I always think that it's more fun to start with the central premise of a question of, is this good rather than this is bad, right? I always find that that's like more of a fun interrogation device for some of the things we take for granted of being trash or, you know, of lower quality culture, and really trying to have like an open and honest discussion about it. So that's kind of part of the reason we come at it from that angle.
But that's a really interesting thing, Kevin, because that assumes a level of respect, or of saying in some way, by saying, instead of saying, is this bad, saying, is this good? I think that for some people may seem subtle, but that's a really important distinction.
I think so, too. And it's an important distinction that I find is oftentimes hard to market and communicate, which is why I always appreciate talking about it in length and on platforms like this, because it is like a tough sell, because that is just so the central assumption of a lot of this stuff, and a lot of stuff, honestly, attached to religions and other cultures, and definitely things that people did not grow up with themselves, and things that might be attached to Jewish culture or things of other faith. You just might assume that it's not at all for you and it has no value. But oftentimes, especially when you take a minute to look into it, there is at least something there that might speak to you and might be of some intrinsic value. Although, to be fair, a lot of times it is a lot of making fun of the thing at hand. So it's both It's not an either or. It's a both and.
Right. Well, it's a very, I would say that's a great improv comedic principle that you've brought into this. So we have to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Kevin Porter. I want to hear a little bit more about your background and when it occurred to you to do this. You can, by the way, for those of you listening, tweet us your favorite podcasts. Our handle's 21STShow as we talk about our favorite podcasts that we've been listening to share with you guys. We'd love to hear from you all. Stay tuned. We'll continue this conversation just after this short break. Thanks for tuning into The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We've been talking about podcasts all week to give you ideas of things when you're traveling. We've covered podcasts that explain the news, podcasts about identity. Right now, tomorrow, we're talking about podcasts for kids. So we'd love to hear your suggestions. We've got a couple, but we'd love to hear from you if you have your favorite podcast that you listen to with children. Right now, I'm talking to Kevin T. Porter. He is the co-host of Good Christian Fun. So, Kevin, I wonder if you can tell us a little bit more about your faith background. I assume you grew up going to church.
Oh yeah. So I grew up in evangelical culture in the suburbs of Texas, specifically Houston. And it was something that culturally was just very pervasive throughout my whole life and my upbringing. I was homeschooled for a good amount of my childhood. So while there wasn't any like strict law and order rule about how much Christian music could or could not be played, there was an implicit one. And it was pretty much the only thing that was on the radio growing up. And it did shape a lot of my musical taste growing up because of that. So I grew up attending a number of different churches in kind of the Houston area.
And when did it occur to you, hey, this is something that I can not just make fun of, but maybe not be so reverent about it, which is, I feel like, a good way to describe. I feel like this podcast is kind of like if you had a theology on tap and a podcast that was really fun, this would be it.
That's very nice. I think the idea that it's something that could be made fun of was an almost immediate one from growing up.
Okay.
I remember we would make our own little like song parodies of certain praise and worship songs growing up during the service when we were kids or like whatever the current.
Oh, you got to tell me one. What was your favorite parody worship song?
Oh, gosh. I mean, anytime it's Hosanna, you change it to Banana, you got yourself a parody song. That was a big go-to. Or Behind Lifted Up became Eat Pie and Lifted Up. So mostly food-based, much like Weird Al's Ovier and his catalog. But that was that was a good deal of it.
And so there's an episode I was listening to, speaking of music, entitled Amy Grant, which, thank you. Now I've had Amy Grant in my head all morning. I think I've been driving the producers crazy because I've been singing Amy Grant songs. But you had a guest, Zach Reno, who's Jewish, his background is Jewish, talk about his faith, or I guess maybe what his faith is right now. And let's take a listen to some of that.
I don't think I have faith in the traditional sense. I think the only faith that I have is faith that's like, I trust that if you jump off of a balcony, you will fall, because that's what all of the evidence that I have seen in my life has led me to believe,
mm-hmm.
right? So I have faith that it will happen again, but it's based on past experience.
Yeah. So that's Zach Reno and the Good Christian Fun podcast. Kevin Porter is with us, one of the co-hosts of it. And Kevin, you guys start off almost every episode by prefacing that you don't need to be Christian to enjoy this. And the first episode, you say you don't want to just preach to the choir. Why is it important to you to have people from different faith backgrounds or to appeal to people of all faith backgrounds with this?
I think for the same reason that inclusion just in general in our lives as a practice is an important principle. Is one, just because it makes everything better. The kind of conversations you have with people about something that's specific to you and that you grew up with, coming from an outside third-party perspective, always gives it a different angle and a different kind of meaning. And I think if we stayed in our sort of one-track, insular, we all grew up with this, and then we all had to deconstruct it in some measure, then we would probably be having the same kind of conversations over and over again. But the beauty about having guys like Zach come on, or people who are atheists or agnostics, or are Jewish religiously or culturally, is that you can have a bunch of different conversations on. So that way the show isn't merely, oh, this stuff was weird that we grew up with, but it also casts a different lens so that the show can also be about faith in general, about reconciling your past in general, that, you know, it can be, it's still the Christian pop culture show, but we're trying to build in other threads of different kinds of shows in it as well, so it can have longevity.
And I wonder what kind of feedback you get from people, if there are people who are mad that you're doing this or find it disrespectful, or if there's just kind of like a whole category of people who kind of flock to it and love it.
Well, famously, Christians are the least sensitive people group on the internet, so we've never gotten any negative feedback. No, but in all sincerity, most of the feedback has been overwhelmingly positive, and we found that the only time we get negative feedback is when people feel tricked by it, because it is kind of a tricky title, and if you are just a person looking for...
Well, if you don't listen to the first 5 seconds, then you won't know what it's about, right?
Exactly. If you just click on it because of the iTunes and the logo looks friendly enough, then you might get tricked. And I always feel bad if people get tricked, so I don't want to do that. That's why we go to great pains to be explicit about our perspectives and aims and purposes at the beginning of the episode. But yeah, I think that's the only time in which we encounter any sort of like substantial negative feedback.
All right. Well, if this is for you, you can check out Good Christian Fun wherever you get your podcasts. Kevin T. Porter is this is his podcast. He's one of the co-hosts. Kevin, thanks for being with us. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
We're compiling a list, by the way, at our website at 21stshow.org of all of these podcasts we've been talking about. We've been sharing podcasts we think you should be listening to this summer. Next up, Nerdette. Every Friday, host Greta Johnson does a deep dive into pop culture, artists, authors, scientists, folks that she can nerd out with. She's on the line with us now from BEZ. Hey, Greta.
Hey, Nyla. How you doing?
I'm good. It's good. Nice to talk to you. Welcome to the 20th.
It's super fun to talk to you, too.
Yes. Yay. So you and your co-creator, Trisha Bobita, got a lot of attention for Nerdette's Game of Thrones recaps with Peter Sagal. For everyone listening in the public radio world, they love him from Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. How did it feel to finally say goodbye to that series and to a side of Nerdette that I think maybe probably brought a lot of people to you?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I was always the one of the three of us who kind of hated Game of Thrones. Like, I was ready to stop watching it when Peter approached us and asked us if we wanted to recap it before season 5.
I think I remember that, yes.
Yeah, for sure. So, I mean, in a lot of ways, I was really relieved. I mean, it's also just, like, really hard. The turnaround on a recap podcast, if you really want to be part of
pretty
the conversation,
grueling,
you know, Game of Thrones would come out Sunday night. We would come in first thing Monday morning and recap the show. I still work weekends, so at that point, my days off were Sunday and Tuesday, which was also, like, not ideal for laundry or meal planning.
Or
so,
life.
I mean, yeah, exactly. So, like, you know, I mean, it's always super fun to hang out with Trisha and Peter, and we had a great time recapping Thrones, but I was kind of ready to be done with it by the time it was over.
So you guys have done episodes on everything from hand washing to deadly sea snails to space. How do you choose what you're going to cover?
I mean, our general metric has just been like, are Trisha or I interested in it? Like, is this something that is fun and could sustain a conversation? And if the answer is yes, then like, yes, let's do it.
And so I wonder how you came across a recent episode. You spoke with Harriet DeWitt, a researcher at University of Chicago, and she and her colleagues are giving hallucinogenic drugs, LSD, ecstasy, to test subjects. How did you guys come across this?
Yeah, so actually a couple of years ago, probably 2 or 3 years ago, I was asked to do a tape sync for another podcast outlet called Gimlet based in New York. They have the show called
Science
Versus.
You should explain what a tape sync is, Greta.
Yes. So a tape sync is
a thing.
This is
so public radio.
It's the most public radio. It's like if you want to do a long distance interview, but you don't want to make that person go into a studio like I am today, you can send a freelancer with a microphone to record their side of the conversation.
This is what we do for our audience. This is what we do to make sure everything sounds perfect.
Totally. And then that freelancer will send the audio to the people in New York and they can stitch it together and it sounds like everybody's in the same room. It's like radio magic. So I had been asked to do this tape sync, which is a great way to just like make some extra money when you have the free time. And they were like, just go see this professor at the University of Chicago. Like that was literally all I knew. So I showed up with my mic and I put it in front of her face and I was listening to all these questions, and she was describing giving ecstasy to people and observing their behavior, and I was like, this is awesome. So yeah, she had been someone kind of in the back of my mind for a couple of years, and then finally we were like, you know what, let's talk to Harriet, it's time.
And one of your, I wanted to play a little audio of an interview you did with Beanie Feldstein and Caitlin Dever. They are two stars in the movie Booksmart. And this starts with Beanie talking about the moment in the film. For people who aren't familiar, this is where her character Molly finds out that all of the kids who partied in their high school also got into good colleges. And that's kind of the premise of the movie for people who haven't seen it.
Yeah.
She thought that they had to choose one or the other.
Right.
She was like, those guys chose that. We're choosing school. And Molly and Amy know that they're fun. That's what we love about the film.
Yes,
they're
totally.
Not trying to learn how to be fun.
And they're not ashamed of being intelligent
right.
and smart.
They're not changing who they are to be
they
able to go
amazing.
To these parties.
At all. Yeah. They're just like, well, we know we're fun, so like, we better show other people that we're fun too.
Yeah. Yeah, I do think there's something really interesting about it in terms of, like, I've been thinking about this a lot, just even in my own career with work and the idea that, like, it's okay to be super dedicated to, like, the thing that is your thing and to work really hard at doing that. But it's also super important to have a holistic life that's like a bunch of other pieces so that you're not just doing school so that you can get the best grades and go to the best school. Because then what do you do with yourself?
You know? It's all about balance, I think.
That was my guest, Greta Johnson from Nerdette, the podcast speaking with stars of the movie Booksmart. Greta, one of the things I really loved about this is I think the ethos of that movie is a lot of what you and Trisha were doing when you started Nerdette, which is projecting, I think, this kind of confidence and excitement about what you're doing, which I feel like for a long time was really not part of our culture. And I wonder what it's like to be doing a podcast like this now when being a nerd is part of mainstream culture, and being proud of that and owning that is really kind of part of our popular culture now.
Yeah, I mean, I think we really have come a long way from the sort of like hipster sarcastic, like, no, I'm too cool for this. If everybody likes Harry Potter, I can't possibly be bothered. I'm really excited to be a part of a conversation where like it's totally okay to just be completely enthusiastic about something. Like I remember, gosh, maybe like a year ago, I had written an email. It was just like a basic pitch email trying to get somebody to come on Nerdette as a guest. And I was proofreading it before I sent it. And I thought to myself, like, maybe there are too many exclamation points in this email. Maybe I should try and play it cool. And then I was like, wait, this is for Nerdette. The whole point is to just be really excited about this. Forget it. I'm putting in more exclamation points. And yeah, I mean, I think especially in like the public radio world where so much of what we're supposed to do is have kind of an emotional distance from what we're talking about. It's so exciting and fun to be in a space where I can just tell someone how much I love what they made and why it's important to me.
Mm-hmm. And so, Greta, I know that you're a bit of a bookworm. And before we let you go, I want to know what you're excited about reading, or if you can give us a preview of Nerdette, some things that you're super excited about for this summer.
Yeah, I can actually answer both of those questions in one answer, because our guest this Friday is Linda Holmes. She hosts a podcast many of you probably know about. It's called Pop Culture Happy Hour. It's from NPR. She's like NPR's pop culture correspondent. And she just wrote her first novel at age 48, which in and of itself I think is awesome. Like thinking about having this like super well-established career in one world and then being like, no, I'm going to like start this whole other creative thing. And she just wrote this book called Evie Drake Starts Over. It comes out on Tuesday. It's about a young widow. She's like ready to leave her husband. She has like cash in the glove box. She's in the driveway. She's about to leave. And then she gets a call that he died in a car accident. This is like the first two pages of the book. And then the other character is this pitcher for the Yankees who gets the yips, which is that thing where like all of a sudden you can't throw right anymore. And so it's about these two characters meeting each other and both kind of trying to figure out how to rebuild their lives and figure out what the point is if this thing that they thought was the whole point doesn't exist anymore. And it's just like such a charming, lovely book. I think it's the perfect summer read. I can't explain enough how great it is.
Oh, now you've given me something to read. I love
this.
All right. So this is Friday's episode. We've gotten a preview. You heard it here first about Nerdette. You can get Nerdette wherever you get your podcasts. Greta Johnson is its host. Hey, Greta, thanks for taking the time to speak with us. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Nyla. It was super fun.
That does it for us today. Tomorrow on the program, there's no shortage of conspiracy theories in American politics. We are going to speak with the University of Chicago political scientist about why people believe conspiracy theories, how they cause divisions in our political life, understand a little bit more about the personality types that go into believing into conspiracies. And trust me, there's a lot of people. This is much more widespread than you would think. Our Twitter handle is 21STShow. We live tweet during the program with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. On our Facebook page, you can also search for The 21st to like us. That's another way to comment on what we're working on. You can message us if you've got questions about what we're doing or things you want us to ask on air. All those links, every other way to contact us. If you'd like to leave us a voicemail, send us an email, or follow us at social media, all you have to go to is our website. That's 21stshow.org. We've got all of our past shows there. You can find us most places you get your podcasts. We're on Spotify now, as well as Apple Podcasts and NPR One. Search for The 21st. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening. We'll see you here tomorrow.